can you take this photo, please?
Excuse me, can you take this photo, please? Oi, douche, can you take this photo, please?
G'day, mate, can you take this photo, please?
Hey,
can you take this photo, please? Can you take this photo, please? With Justin Hamilton and Bronny Robinson.
Welcome to the latest podcast of Can You Take This Photo, Please? My name is Justin Hamilton. I'm in the studio with Bron Robinson. How are you, Bron?
Good, I think.
You think?
I think. I'm a bit tired, but yeah. You know.
You've been working 15-hour days.
Yeah. What a fuck.
Yeah. There's really not much more to say to it than that.
No, there's not.
Yeah.
So I'm barely standing up, but
what,
I'm here.
What's happening? You're working radio in the morning, is that right?
Yeah, office during the day,
yep,
and then radio at night,
yep.
And then the other week it was radio in the morning, and then office all day.
Is there a preference?
Radio.
Radio. Oh, just radio.
You know why? Because it's easy.
Yeah.
No one's around when I'm here.
Yeah. There's something about just having no one to get you in trouble.
Oh yeah, and it doesn't matter if you come in staggering.
Yeah.
Because whatever, mate.
Yeah. You know, because as long as you get the job done.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter if you're wearing a t-shirt that says, you know, my friend went to Italy and all they brought back was a fuckhead. I don't even know quite what that means. But, you know, the thing is I'm pretty excited about this podcast because got to talk to Tony Martin.
Oh, I know. The genius, Tony Martin.
Oh, man. I've been such a fan of his for so long. And
yeah.
I was very lucky to appear on Get This a few times, you know, with Ed and the late and wonderful Richard Marsden.
Yeah.
And also got to work with Tony on The Librarians with Wayne Hope and Robin Butler and all that amazing crew. So I had a chat with him and we had to chat during the day, which is why there's no you in this.
I know, but I'm so looking forward to listening to it. He's one of my heroes.
Well, you should enjoy this. I'll point out now, Tony has so many interesting stories that we talk about how he started off and how he came to Australia, and it's all fascinating. But I'll tell you here and now, we essentially get to roughly The Late Show and a little bit of radio. So we'll have to have him back.
Definitely.
You know, so, you know, these are the early years. We'll do the middle years, then we'll do the later years.
It's the wonder years.
It's the wonder years, the Tony Martin wonder years.
Yeah.
Well, look, let's have a listen to Tony Martin and I. We were at the Vic Hotel in Melbourne, having a bit of a chat and listen to the nice little music being played in the background. I'm with Tony Martin at the Vic Hotel, which at the moment, I don't know if you can hear this in the background, but we have the lady who, I think she's homeless, but she, for as long as I've been performing at the comedy festival, she comes in and just plays the piano. And
right.
It turns out she comes in during the day as well.
Fantastic. Are there any other acts regularly on here at the mezzanine?
No, there isn't. She's got a residency, and if you try to get on, it will go down.
Where's the bloke who just talks to himself? Surely he's, I think he's on at 3:30.
He's on at 3:30. You don't want things. So they actually do a lot of, go to a lot of effort to, you know, make sure that you don't miss out on an act.
Excellent.
So we were just saying beforehand, before we'd even press play.
Yep.
So it seems that people who get attacked in the media don't realise that if you don't want people to know about it, you shouldn't make a big deal about it, essentially. So what's happened?
Oh, well, I was just explaining how, I did some clips for Wayne Hope and Robin Butler's website, gristmill.com. And, they were sitting on about 200 views for about 3 weeks, and then suddenly a bloke who writes for the Daily Telegraph got onto it and, you know, left-hard humour.
Yeah.
And went to 3,000 overnight and then to 6,000 by the end of the weekend. So, yeah.
Was everyone having an attack at you, or were some people?
There were quite a lot of attacks. What I love is when, you know, and people tell me not to read the comments, but I do like to read them because they always accord me with much more academic qualifications than I have. I have no education whatsoever. And the comments are always full of things like, Tony Martin, you can smell the uni degrees.
It's a form of racism. It's because you wear glasses.
It must
be what it is.
It's interesting, isn't it? These we've seen it with blogs, we've seen it with you know, these things on YouTube. Mm. If the right wing victims, as they like to portray themselves, don't bring attention to it,
no
one would know about it.
No, that's right.
And if you want to kill something, you just give it no oxygen.
Well, what I find is the main thing is anyone who's having a go is immediately tagged by your News Limited types, your Tim Blairs and your Miranda Devines and your Andrew Bolts, as the elite media. And you're going, well, hang on a second, that News Limited own 70% of the newspapers in this country.
Yeah.
Someone like Andrew Bolt has, I mean, admittedly, apart from his column in the Herald Sun and his column in the Weekend Herald Sun, his column in the Brisbane newspaper and his appearances on his own TV show and his appearances on NTR and his book, he has no outlets whatsoever.
Nothing.
For his views. So, I mean, what could be more elite than writing for News Limited? To me, that's the elite journalism in this country. You know, whereas apparently it's Rod Quantock living in a share house in Brunswick. He's apparently part of the elite.
Yeah, he's running the country from a share house. You know, it's interesting because, and I think you've seen this in America, that the right-wing political parties over there have taken on a lot of what Obama was doing to get into power and then trying to make it about themselves. We don't want big government. We don't want this. We don't want that. Even though they've been doing a very good job of that for 8 years.
Well, it's about, you know, climate change has given everyone an excuse to turn it into a class war.
Yes.
So Tony Abbott doesn't have to do anything. He just has to say, well, no one can afford the carbon tax, so therefore it's a rich person's problem.
Yeah.
And therefore it's a class problem. But what I just love is you read your Bolts and your Devines and your Blairs, they're all about saying to the reader, hey, battlers, man, I'm one of you. We don't want these intellectual elites in the city telling. And you go, hang on a second, where do you live?
Yeah.
Where do you think, is Miranda Devine eating out of a dump master in Cranbourne? I don't think she is. She's probably, I would guess, sipping a latte in the inner city. There was an article.
A skinny latte, at best.
Wayne Hope showed me an article recently with a picture of Andrew Bolt at home writing his column in like a sort of very expensive looking Victorian kind of lounge room full of leather Chesterfields everywhere.
Right.
But he's the battler's mate.
Yeah, he's one of the people.
Yeah, he's not one of these inner city elitists.
It is phenomenal that these people go on the attack and, you know, like, what I don't understand is, do they believe it? Do you think they honestly believe that they are one of the people when they're looking around their Baroque house and, you know, not, you know, sitting in, like, they might go to the sport, but they'd be in the members. Do you know what I mean? Like, do you think they have any idea of the irony of what they're doing, or do you think they truly believe it?
They must be, but it's, they've got to act like they've got to act straight-faced about it, because it's all about, you know, I always remember someone said about the miracle of George W. Bush was he got poor people to vote for tax cuts for rich people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how News Limited works.
Yeah.
It's all about saying, you know, hey, battlers, we're your mates. We're doing this all in your interests.
Yeah.
And it's, you've got to maintain that illusion. So,
you know what I find the most interesting thing about the climate change situation is, you know, I don't have kids and don't plan on having kids, so seriously, you know, for me, who gives a fuck? I'll be gone before this shit gets really heinous. But, you know, who loses in doing the right thing by the environment? Like, just say climate change isn't caused by man and it's just something that's happening. Isn't just going through the process of cleaning up pollution, cleaning up the streets, you know, being a little bit more aware, doesn't that just benefit everyone anyway?
Well, I don't know who. When you see the people who are outraged, a lot of them are in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming a lot of them going, well, you know, according to Tim Flannery, there's not going to be any benefits for 1,000 years. Bugger that.
Yeah, I'm out of here.
Party on.
They're burning tyres, you know, just setting some rubber on fire in the house. You know, when you started out, when you weren't going to university in New Zealand, were you political as a young man?
No, not at all. And I'm not even sure that I am, that the material I do is particularly political. It's more about information and the media and how it's presented and the scam of of trying to turn it into a class war. To me, that's funny. There's a lot of amusement value there. And I'm not Rod Quantock. I don't go around leading protests and things. Everything I do is to get to a joke first.
Yeah.
And when you're looking for jokes, you're looking for absurdity and you're looking for hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And you're looking for, you know, you're looking for the Bolt report, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anything that paints a nice target on itself. Because I've always found your humour comes from a place of lower status, which is, you know, lower status as in you're not on stage or on your radio shows or whatever you're doing saying, how cool am I? Everything else is fucked. I always find it's more a case of pointing out those absurdities of the big targets and also a celebration of, you know, TV shows that we've forgotten or, you know, or pop culture that has been placed under the carpet and you know, kind of mistakenly, you know, oh, we don't want to talk about that anymore. And you're like, no, check this shit out and bring it back to the fore.
I'm always concerned with trivial, tiny things. So things that wedge in your brain and that amuse you. And I work outwards from that. And it's an interesting situation with myself and Ed Cavalier, who are back together working on a show for Andrew Denton's company. And Andrew Denton is kind of comes at it from the big picture. And I remember when I was younger, he would do shows like blah, 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 and the money or the gun, and he would take a massive topic and sort of look down on it from a plane.
Yeah.
And I always admired that because I've never been able to do that. So what we've got now is these two styles coming together where Andrew Denton will go, let's have a look at all of television and look at why things are the way they are, whereas Ed and I will start at the other side. We'll find some tiny little aspect and then find some other little thing that's funny and join it together, and hopefully molecule by molecule it'll build outwards into a big picture. But he starts with the big picture and looks down.
Has that been... what's that been like, working with someone coming from such a different angle?
Well, it's I'm looking forward to it because it's making me think about things differently. And I've sort of... I mean, I think one of the reasons I've done so many things that haven't been as successful as I thought they were going to be is because I never really have my eye on the big picture. I'm just looking for little jokes here and there and hoping that they'll add up to something big.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah. Were you funny as a kid when you were starting out?
I did. I made a lot of jokes at school and they were really poor. I had really quite a poor sense of humour at school. Puns.
Yeah.
And I was a cartoonist and I did a lot of cartoons and things, and
was it an ongoing cartoon or was it just cartoon like one off?
I did the school I took over the school magazine for a couple of years and I've got it, and the drawings are quite good but the jokes are shit house, all stolen from Monty Python. I think that's what happens is when you, certainly in New Zealand when I was growing up, there was no local comedy really. There was Fred Dagg and then he went off to Australia and there was another couple of guys called Mick Fail and Gadsby, but there was certainly no live, you couldn't go down to the Last Laugh the way you can now in Auckland. I think there's some. I think they have a comedy festival there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if there's regular comedy nights every week, but there certainly is every month.
But that's how you start off, isn't it? You mimic what you like and then develop from there.
Well, I didn't get into writing until it became a necessity because there was no comedy venues. I was in amateur theatre.
Right.
So I did 4 years of, you know, No Sex Please, We're British kind of terrible British farces and Alan Ackbourne plays and stuff that and working behind the scenes on them. And I'm going, these jokes are appalling, but it was the only way you could get a laugh in front of an audience was to go out and do a play. And then I always think... do you know, are you old enough to know who Los Trios Rinbarkers
are? Yeah. That was my introduction into, you know, live Australian comedy.
Really?
It was I just started noticing who they were. I saw some TV spots, etc., where they would come on. I have a vague recollection of maybe Vizard and them coming on and just stinking up the stage. Or, you know, I remember them on something and thinking, wow, this is...
The 11th Hour, I think maybe they were on that with...
Yeah.
But they won the Perrier Award.
They won the Perrier,
the second one ever.
Yeah, and so then that was the gateway into the big gig. It was the big gig that I saw them on. But I do remember seeing them at a very young age.
It was Neil Gladwin and Steve Kearney, and they were a double act. And
it was complete anarchy.
It was complete anarchy. Yeah. The stage would just be covered in suntan lotion and banana skins and broken crackers by the end of the show. And the audience would be wringing out their clothes out on the footpath. But they came to Auckland when I was living there in 83. on their rampant stupidity tour. And I always say that that was like the invention of the wheel as far as live comedy goes, because they performed in pubs. No one had ever seen that before.
Yeah.
It was like cavemen looking at fire. You just saw all these people at the back of the Windsor Castle in Parnell and Auckland going, hang on, sorry, so you can come to a pub and not just see a band.
Yeah.
So that was a, you could feel light bulbs going off all over, and within a year there was a comedy venue which operated once a month in Auckland. By that time I'd left.
Right.
But
how old were you when you saw Los Trios?
83, I would have been 19.
Yeah, perfect.
When I saw that. But I remember the only way you could do comedy in Auckland was sometimes you could sneak on before a band and do 2 minutes if your act was musical.
Right.
And so the first thing I think I did that could be called like stand-up or comedy was John Cooper Clarke. Do you know who that is?
No.
He's a Mancunian poet who talks in a very monotone voice like that. Accidentally Kelly Street. Oh, my God, Beasley Street. His song was gone. Oh, my God, what a confusion. He did a song called Beasley Street. He just talked in a very sort of broad Mancunian, reads out his poems like that continuously, like endless sentences, unbroken. And I saw him live, and he was a really skinny guy in a tight black suit with a huge sort of rat's nest of hair, and he wore sunglasses. And he actually toured here a couple of years ago, and we had him on Get This, bizarrely, on Triple M, one of the oddest guests ever. But and I saw him, and he would just perform with a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he was amazing. He's like, he did some great albums. And so I went and bought a suit from an op shop, got a wig, got some sunglasses, and I was really skinny, so I just looked exactly like him.
Yeah.
Got a tape recorder with some beats on it, and my act was, I would just get up and do, I've been rolling down the road trying to loosen my load, I got seven women on my mind, just doing Eagle songs as John Cooper Clarke. And so I did about, that was a 2 minute, maybe a 3 minute act. And that was the first time I was able to get up in a non-theatre environment. And I think people were just baffled. They were just confused.
Was it exciting, though?
It was exciting, because you could see, you're going, surely this is going to go somewhere. I don't think I'd even heard of the idea of a comedy club, because this would have been just before the boom in the 80s in America of, you know, people standing in front of a brick wall.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we just hadn't heard of that in New Zealand. Obviously, it was going on in Australia. And then I moved back to Hamilton, which is like moving from Melbourne to Geelong.
Right.
And a month after I left, there was a regular comedy night, and there was a group called Funny Business, who became a successful sketch comedy group and did live shows. And then that sort of just snowballed, and by the 90s you had the Cal Wilsons and the Allen Bros, and then there was suddenly a comedy circuit.
So what brought you to Australia initially?
Well, I came over writing, I was working for a radio station, Hamilton, and our sister station was FM 104, now Triple M, in Brisbane.
Right.
And the manager was from Brisbane, was visiting, you know, like Prince Philip visiting a factory. And he was just having a look. And while he was there, like an amazing fluke, in the week he was there, his copywriter, his advertising copywriter in Brisbane, quit her job.
Right.
And he just went, have you got anyone here who can do this? And they played him a couple of my ads, and I had to get a I remember I didn't have a passport, and I just moved to Brisbane just to write ads.
Right, with complete faith, just went, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, and just hoping that maybe there was some way of doing comedy, because by that time I was in a touring sketch review group.
Right.
But we were quite twee. It was, I think we were, what was it called? There were four of us. I think we were called Stage Style.
Style.
It was awful. There was a lot of clown work in it. There was some actual comedy, but that was where I first wrote comedy sketches. And I remember thinking, oh, right, you know, writing my own stuff that didn't sound like a rip-off of Monty Python. So that was the idea, that maybe if I went to Australia, I'd get into comedy. So I went over to write ads, but then I got a comedy show on Brisbane radio once a week, a five-minute comedy show on The Breakfast Show. It was called Not Quite the News,
right,
which wasn't my... I wanted it to be called Mounting Concern, but people just looked at me confused. And that sort of did quite well. But what happened with the conversely, what happened, I don't even know if that's the correct use of the word conversely, but I'll keep it in there. Because my accent was so thick, my New Zealand accent, I couldn't I just couldn't get into any plays. Right. I couldn't even get on radio. I had to learn to lose my accent before I could do comedy. So it took quite a while to get back on stage.
That's a mild form of racism, isn't it?
It was. Well, in the 80s, you couldn't have one, but now it's quite cool to have a New Zealand accent.
In the 80s, of course, that was when cricket would be saying, this summer, here come the Packies.
That's right.
When you look back on it, you go, that was the marketing campaign.
Well, I used to do one of the sketches I did in New Zealand in the touring show was me and another bloke just got up and did Richie Beno and who was the other? Tony Greig?
Tony Greig, yeah.
And we didn't even have any jokes.
We just
did the voices. I think we just read out actual cricket commentaries and people thought it was hilarious. It was like the Australian accent in those days at least was as funny to New Zealanders as the reverse.
Yeah, that's one of the bad things about the proliferation of YouTube, etc. is that now the accents are just so commonplace.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Alan hasn't. I went to a dinner, remember, a few years ago and there was John Clark who came over in the 70s, me came over in the 80s and Alan Bro came over in the 90s, the three of us having dinner. And
wow.
And remember me and Clarkie, you could see us slowly realising, hang on, Alan's still got the voice.
Yeah.
He hasn't had to lose the voice.
Yeah, the young fella came over at a much more accepting time.
Yeah, yeah.
So how old were you when you hit Brisbane then?
That was middle of 85, so I would have been 21.
Yeah. And did you just learn, because you're such an excellent writer, did you just learn by writing?
Writing ads, and people will, mock, rightly so, all the cliches of writing commercials, but what it does, it really teaches you to edit, because an ad has to go, on radio, has to go 29 and a half seconds.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of losing syllables.
Yeah.
And it constantly makes you hone it down. I had to write, 100 ads a week when I was in New Zealand, and, most of them were just, there's never been a better time to dot, dot, dot. But you do learn to, lose that word, can those three words be replaced by two words here? And that sort of clock, that constantly having a 30-second clock in your head, has always stayed with me, and I'm always trying to hone and lose words. So that was a good discipline, but not really for writing comedy. What happens, and a lot of people in advertising would know this, is I got into advertising. I was in the art department, and I got into the writing department because I wanted to write funny ads, because there was such a thing in those days. You'd hear funny radio ads, and what happens is you write a funny idea, the client doesn't like it, and you go, but this is a funny idea, and then the client goes, but I want Mrs. Marsh with her chalk.
That was
the most, they will always cite that one. I think that's the most successful ad of all time.
The Colgate ad.
And you go, but this is funny, and then it's like, well, if you want to write comedy, go and write it on your own time. So and that's what people end up doing.
Yeah, which is the best advice you can get.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but what was great in radio was that, I was being paid to write ads, but I had the full run of the station and the production facilities, so I would stay behind after work and write sketches and get into production and, learn to cut tape and go through old, KPM albums looking for music. You could write fake ads to, and just all the toys of radio were there.
So how long were you in Brisbane then?
I was in Brisbane for about a year, and I had a horrible incident, which is recounted in one of my books, where I got drunk at the Goldie Awards and swore at some people and basically got sacked. Well, no, not really. What happened was I was writing ads, and the comedy show I was doing for free just in my spare time was becoming more and more popular, and the manager kept saying, look, eventually we'll take you off the ads and we'll give you the comedy show.
Right.
And then I caused this horrible incident where I swore at this radio station. I had to write a written apology to a lot of the clients. But then the tide started to turn and people started calling up going, we want the swearing guy to write our ads.
Right.
And so I could see I was just always going to be writing, thinking about carpet. And I just was never going to get to do comedy. And I remember the interesting thing was there was hardly any comedy. I mean, I thought in Brisbane there would be heaps of comedy. There wasn't. There was not really much live comedy. There was a theatre group called La Boite that had a sketch comedy night once a week. And on TV, in that year that I was there, I remember they repeated Australia, You're Standing In It.
Yep.
And Jono and Dano had a show called Late Night with Jono and Dano, which I think was only shown in Sydney.
Right,
which was a kind of a version of the Letterman show. I'm pretty sure that's the only Australian comedy that was on that whole time.
Yeah, right.
And then the D-Generation came on, which was before the Young Ones.
Yes, that was a that was a pretty... I can remember that quite vividly. Wasn't Rob Sitch, didn't he used to... Who was it?
Sir Ninian Stevens.
And he was... everyone would finish off with him doing that, and then it would go into the Young Ones.
Young Ones. And people who taped the Young Ones and videotape would get the last... would always get the end of the D-Generation, get that Sir Ninian Stevens
game. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'd written away... Sorry, I have told this story a lot of times before, but it's been so long, I'm trying to remember the chronology. That's right, I'd written away... I'd seen an article in the TV Week about the D-Generation. I'd loved Australia Standing in it, what I'd seen of that. And I went, oh, this is from the same people.
And then for younger people, that was Rod Quantock, that was Tim and Debbie, who were
Stephen
were
Blackburn and Mary Kennelly, and Jeff Brooks, who was Bruce Rumpf, that was a send-up of Bruce Rux. And a lot of them went over to Fast Forward.
Fast Forward, yeah.
Years later. And they, yeah, it was two series of that, and then... the people, a lot of the people who'd made that, not any of the talent, but the production people went on to do the D-Generation. An article in the TV Week about the D-Generation being in production, and there was a hilarious photo of everyone dressed as Mad Max 2 characters with push-on, with one of those lawnmowers that you push them.
Yeah,
a push lawnmower, something from the past. And they
look it up on Google, kids.
And I wrote away. That's right. I wrote away and said, "Can I?" Because I'd written to so many. I'd written to Jonathan Coleman to ask.
Really?
I've still got a letter, a form letter I got back from Jonathan Coleman being rejected as, and rightly, they didn't need any writers for that show. And I'd written away to Australia Standing in it, not realising it wasn't in production anymore. And then I saw this picture in the TV Week, and I wrote away to the ABC, and then just never heard from anyone. 2 months later, the show went to air, so it was too late to get a job on it. It was already going to air. Then I think I left my job. I was on the dole for a couple of months. I had about $700. I didn't have enough money to get back to New Zealand. It was just a disaster.
Yeah.
And then this letter arrived 5 months later, and it was from Chris Noble, who was running the ABC comedy department. And he said, look, we've just opened your letter. The show's been made. But John Alsop has listened to your cassette, because I'd sent them a cassette of my sketches from FM 104.
Yeah.
And John Alsop, who would probably be best known now as the writer of Brides of Christ, he was sort of the comedy, like the person who assessed, you know, scripts when they came in. But he was also, he was in a comedy team with Andrew Knight back in the 70s.
Right.
They were like a Fry and Laurie of Melbourne back in the 70s. And he and Andrew Knight were the two script editors on the D-Generation.
Yeah, right.
And also had listened to my tape. And years later, I remember Chris Noble gave me his piece of paper with his assessment, and it just said, very Monty Python, but then who in radio isn't, could be good for Gillies. Which was the Gillies Report.
Yeah.
So the Gillies Report had finished as well, but they were doing a new series called The Gillies Republic, which was a disaster. It ended up being the Grease 2 of Gillies. John Clark had left, Patrick Cook had left. And so Chris Noble said to me, right, I didn't even know what Gillies was. He said, go and write some sketches for Max Gillies based on today's paper, and send them in, and then you might be able to be a junior writer.
Right.
So I went and rented the Gillies video and didn't know anything about Australian politics, wrote some sketches, wrote a song called... This was when South Africa was quite different than it is today.
Yeah.
And I wrote a song called Cape Town Racists to the tune of Camp Town Races.
Yeah.
And I sent that in, and Chris Noble called me up and said, shit house, we can't use any of this, but if you want to make your own way down here, we will pay you $200 a week to be a researcher, which meant just cutting out newspaper articles in the pre-internet era and putting them into categories for the writers to work from.
Right.
So I went down, got in the bus, and that's the bus trip that's in one of my books about whether there was an argument about whether we could watch Spinal Tap or not. And came down and got worked on that for... That's, and when I came down... Is this all too boring, by the way?
No. Okay. I'm finding this fascinating.
When I came down, they were in production on a show called While You're Down There, which no one remembers, which was a sketch comedy show kind of ripped off from Saturday Night Live.
Right.
6 half-hours with Richard Stubbs, Glenn Robbins, Gina Riley, Mark Neal.
Oh, no, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it only was one season.
One season, six eps, yeah.
I remember, I think that's where I first discovered Glenn Robbins.
Yeah, Glenn was great.
I think he was doing...
Uncle Arthur.
Yeah.
He did Uncle Arthur.
I think he did a plane routine, you know, doing the...
Yeah,
you know.
He did a great character called Gary Quest, who was this pre-Larry Sanders version of Larry Sanders.
Yeah.
This obnoxious talk show host who was always going, somebody, 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 wanting people to bring him things. I think he did it again on the Comedy Company years later as Gary Dare. I always thought right. Gary Quest was a better name.
Yeah.
But that was... So I got to see that being... The last two episodes of that being made. And that was my first look at TV comedy, and Tom Gleisner was the head writer on that show.
Right.
And so I met Tom, and then after that, after Gillies, which was a brilliant thing to work on because it was, you know, people will say you can learn so much more on a bad show than a good show.
Yeah.
You're just seeing how not to do everything. So I got to spend 3 months sitting in the corner of a writer's room on what was a fucking disaster.
Yes.
I mean, it was just, it was famous. There were quite a few famous moments. A guy called Mark Little, would you know who that
is? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he became really well known on Neighbours. And then he's been in the UK ever since.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was just on that show Whites recently. I hadn't seen him for years. But he was a huge comic in Melbourne in the 1980s, and he was in the show. And I won't name the head writer, but the head writer on the Gillies Republic famously had said, I don't want this show to be funny, I want it to be terrifying. And meaning like Dr. Strangelove or something, or Network, it was going to be satirical. And it was, they hired all these people who were great writers, but who'd never written sketch comedy, like Stephen Sewell, who later wrote that hilarious film, The Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was... they'd have these live nights, and it was just going so badly, and Mark Little would always get the most laughs on the live night, and then he would, it would be on Saturday night, and then it would go to air on Monday, and he'd discover that all his stuff had been cut out.
Right.
So after 3 weeks of this, he stood up at the writer's room and just went the entire room, went the head writer and said, mate, you wanted it... You said you didn't want it to be funny, you wanted it to be terrifying. Well, you got the first part right. Stormed off, went to England and never came back.
Right.
And so that was the kind of atmosphere that that show was made in. And there were some great people working on it. Tracy Harvey was in it. And she, the very first writing I ever got onto TV was writing some sketches for her character. And I think I got some sketches into the last couple of episodes. But that was a debacle. Great people. Don Watson was one of the writers on it. And it was directed by Michael Jenkins, who later did Blue Murder, which is great. But I don't think he'd done sketch comedy before. And so I did that and then was on The Dole for a while. And then I got onto Rubbery Figures. Would you know what that is? That was it's like a very cheap version of Spitting Image made by cartoonist Peter Nicholson. And he used to make it out of his... he had a house in North Melbourne, and his brother had the house next door, and that was their production studio.
Yeah,
so they'd make this 5-minute show on 16 mil film, and it would go out at the end of Four Corners on Monday nights.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that.
But it was like film school. It was like, it was only about five of us working on it, and we did everything. Like, me and Marianne Fay were the puppeteers.
Right.
And then I would also do sound effects editing. Got learned how to use a Steenbeck, and I did sound effects. I did some of the voice. All the voices were done by a guy called Paul Jennings, and I think there were two voices he couldn't do.
Right.
He couldn't do Sir Joe Bjelke Petersen, so I got to do that. And then that ended, and I just went, well, that's it, you know, time to go back to New Zealand. And then the phone rang, and it was Tom Gleisner, and he said, we're doing a second series of Degeneration. Rob Sitch is going back to medical school. He'll still be in the show, but he won't be writing for it. And we found your tape here at the ABC, and yes, it is very Monty Python, but, you know... How would you like to join the writing team? Which at that stage was just Tom and Santo and Rob. So it became Tom and Santo and me.
Right.
And that was how I got into Degeneration as one of the writers.
Geez, like, I've always heard that Rob Sitch is a smart guy, but he was studying to be a doctor and performing comedy in his spare time.
He's like a brainiac. He can fly a plane.
Really? Yeah, he can do everything.
He learns things very quickly.
I've got a friend like that, you know, if you give him a drill 15 minutes later, he's a fucking dentist.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's what Rob's like.
Right.
Yeah, I think he can do a bit of dentistry. But he... Yeah, he went off to medical school for 2 years. Was still in the shows.
Yeah.
But he wasn't writing for them. If he hadn't done that, I wouldn't be sitting here now. So
yeah.
That was cool. And then... And I think I mentioned this lots of times, but I the first sketch I wrote saved my job. It was about... it was called Hijack Bloopers, and it was... The concept of bloopers shows on TV was a new one
yeah.
in 1986.
Yeah.
And so I just did some guys, you know, some terrorists doing we've taken everyone on this plane hostage, bloody blah, one of those videos. The cops are looking at the tape and then they're about to leave and someone goes, come back, there's a bit more. And the hostage goes, you know, sometimes the terrorist goes, sometimes right. when you make a tape like this, things go wrong.
Yeah.
And there were all the bloopers. And
lots of laughing. It was like, yeah. there was a blooper that all...
People cracking up.
Yeah.
But what was also good about that was it all the bloopers in the sketch were improvised and there'd never been the D generation didn't do it. There was no impro on Australian TV whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that had a slightly different tone and it worked really well and they would show it to the audience as a warm-up sketch. But then and that was the first thing I wrote. And then the next 30 things I wrote were just shit outs.
Yeah.
And I was having giant sets built for sketches that died in the arse.
Yeah,
I remember
right.
I had a huge set made of the interior of the Kremlin because there was a phenomenon in Australia. People probably wouldn't even remember this. It was called nuclear-free zones. You remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do
Suburbs
remember that.
Would
yeah.
declare themselves.
Nuclear-free.
You know, like South you know. Yarra would go, we're going nuclear-free.
Yeah. And so Russia would then go, well, we better take them off the hit list.
That's exactly yeah. what the sketch was. On a massive scale
yeah.
and it was just them going South Yarra what now and so and it died, it didn't work and this kept happening and I remember Rob would come in from medical school to do the live nights and he'd go, how's that new bloke going? And they'd go, oh well, this didn't work very well. And Rob would go, yeah, but he did do that hijack sketch.
Yeah,
so
right.
the hijack sketch, I think, saved my job. And then Magda Jabanski got me into the cast because they needed, to open the series, they needed someone who wasn't in the cast to play a nerdy price check person at the supermarket. So I sort yeah. of wangled my way into the cast as well.
Right. How as a young guy do you keep the faith when, you know, you've had a bit of success, you know, with that first skit and then and everything else is working? How do you keep the faith of producing work?
Luckily, Tom and Santo just were like my two dads. You know,
yeah.
they were sort of mentoring me and I get quite depressed and they go, you know, Tom would pull out some sketch of his from the bottom drawer that hadn't worked. And they were incredibly nice to me.
Yeah.
And gave me far too much rope. But then what happened was at the end of that, the series ended, and Tom, Rob, and Santo had simultaneously been doing sketches on what's now Triple M was Eon FM
yep.
for John Peters' breakfast show. They've been doing
right.
10 sketches a week, including Graham and the Colonel. That was one of them.
Yes.
And Lee Simon, host of Night Moves, who ran Triple M, loved those sketches and said, when you finish your TV series, come and work full time. And, of course, Rob had gone to medical school, so Tom and Santo said, do you want to come and do that? And then suddenly, whereas I'd been on the bottom of the pecking order, because I'd done so much radio. Suddenly, it wasn't like I was on top, but I just could do all these things that
yeah.
those guys had never done. I did impressions and
yeah.
knew what albums the best sound effects were on and
yeah.
where the bits of music would be. And
it helped equalise things
yeah.
a little bit.
It really saved my... those two things really saved my job, definitely.
Yeah.
yeah.
I remember as a kid being shattered. Because I was in Adelaide,
right.
so I was shattered when the D-Gen wasn't on anymore. Like that was a really formulative, you know, the D-Gen going into the Young Ones was a very important moment as a guy liking comedy.
Right.
You know what I mean? They were the
but see,
that really
was for me too, because
yeah.
I mean, I saw that first series just as a punter, like everyone
yeah.
else. And what I remember is, I loved Australia Standing in it, but it still had. It was still of the previous generation. It was what
yep.
we used to call, and I guess we meant it sort of insultingly, but I don't mean it that like that now. We used to call it Whitlam era comedy.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
it was very Auntie Jack,
yep.
very political.
Yeah,
and the D generation was the first show that just did silly jokes about American TV shows. It
yep.
felt like. It felt more like where our experience was from. You know,
yeah.
in those days it was like, don't make jokes about certain things because... I'll give you an example. I remember when we did The Late Show. I remember Ted Robinson, who produced it, never really he was sort of forced to make the show. I don't think he wanted to make it.
Right.
And he was not really a fan of it. And I remember after the second pilot, we'd done a sketch. And it was a political sketch with a debate. But for some reason, we just called one of the politicians in it, we needed a name, so we just called him Senator Roscoe P. Coltrane. That mate, we just thought that was hilarious.
Yeah.
But he was, I remember him taking me aside and going, I want you to explain to me why that's meant to be funny. And I remember thinking that was like a line in the sand. There were comedians who, of our generation, would find calling an Australian politician Senator Roscoe P. Coltrane funny.
Yeah.
And the older ones wouldn't.
Yeah.
And would think that was a wasted satirical moment.
Yeah,
and why are you referencing something American? There was that sort of line in the sand. And the D-Generation was the first show where I think this feels like my humour. These are the sort of jokes I would make.
Yeah. Well, how long did you guys do radio for then?
We did that for, well, counting the year before where they were part-time, it was 6 years in total. Yeah. I was on there for 5 years.
Yeah.
And originally it was just me, Tom and Santo. And we were paid nothing for... I mean, we were paid, for the first year and a half, we were paid $1,000 between the three of us. And then Michael Veitch came on board, and I remember us begging for another $200 so that Michael Veitch could join the team.
Wow.
And originally we were writing for, it was supposed to be for John Peters, doing just the sketches. And then he left, and Ian Grace, who ran the place, brought in Jono and Dano from Sydney.
Yeah.
And then Jono left, and we had just Dano. And
because Jono went overseas, didn't he?
Yeah.
Did he go to the UK for a while?
That's right, yeah. He was on the Big Breakfast, or something. Well, maybe he was the Big Breakfast. But he went overseas, and then, yeah, we had Dano for a while. Then we had a guy called Peter O'Callaghan, who'd been the announcer on Richard Stubbs' XY Zoo. God, this is like such a museum of old radio shows, this podcast. And then the night we all remember was in, I think it was September 1988, Ian Grace called us up and said, I've sacked Peter O'Callaghan. This was at 10 o'clock at night. Tomorrow morning, you guys are hosting the show yourselves.
Oh.
And I think at that point, there had never been a show, perhaps anywhere in Australia, on commercial radio where there was no what we used to call chaperone, where there wasn't an announcer.
Yeah.
You know how you have a couple of comedians ever going, hey, thanks Justin. We'll be back with more in a moment with Justin Hamilton. That's sort of the proper announcer. And because I'd done a sort of half-assed version of proper announcing, me and Tom, we were called Tommy G and the Fat Man, sadly. I was the Fat Man for 5 years on Melbourne Radio. I still get people yell Fat Man at me from cars. We became the hosts. And I remember it was such a radical idea that more than half of the staff at Eon FM were furious.
Yeah.
It was like, this is like the lunatics running the asylum and it'll never work. And it's like Triple R.
Yeah.
And then there was only 4 rating surveys a year at that time, and the first survey came out in December, and they got everyone into the boardroom, and the ratings had gone from 7 to 12. They'd gone up 5 points in one survey.
That's phenomenal.
And I remember half the staff were angry. They were like,
you'd been successful.
They were like kicking, going, that can't be right.
Yeah.
This shambles can't be working. And then it was just such an unusual idea to not have a proper announcer anchoring it. So, and that went on all through 1989, which is probably was the best year of that show, because that's when Rob came back and joined full time. And
he finished being a doctor and you know, climbing Mount Everest and, you know. And
that's right, and splitting the atom.
Yeah.
But then we started to do, because we'd done some TV shows on Channel 7, we'd done specials. They hadn't quite worked because you couldn't get a running joke going when there was only an episode every 3 months.
Yeah, I remember the cowboy band. Were you guys all cowboys or country western music?
That was the last special because we'd spent so much money on the third one, which was Shit House, called The Salute to Roy Smek. Hadn't worked at all. It was terrible.
Yes.
And there was no money left, so we couldn't afford a set or anything. So we called it the D-Generation's Country Homestead.
Yes.
And the idea was that everyone was... The security guy wouldn't let anyone in, so we had to do the hosting stuff on the security camera outside the door.
That's right, yeah.
A single hay bale.
Yeah.
And that became the linking material for the
series. I
remember
seeing that and thinking it was pretty funny.
Well, a lot of those... The best things we did were budgetary, because the thing we did that people liked the most was... the genocide where we dubbed over homicide.
Yeah.
And that was just because we had spent so much money on sets in the first special. We went, we have to do something in the second one that costs no money to do.
Yeah.
What can we... And we'd loved that film, What's Up Tiger Lily, with, yeah. with Woody Allen, where he overdubbed... The
James Bond movie.
I think he might have been the first person to do that. So we stole that idea, essentially, and got 12 minutes of material out of it. So those had been fun to do, but they hadn't been a success because what had happened at that time was the Comedy Company had come on.
Yeah.
And they were doing like 30 shows a year.
Yeah.
And so we realised you've got to do a series. You can't just... Four specials is fine if you're Paul Hogan and everyone knows who you are, but nobody really knew who we were.
People forget in the time that you've been on, and it's like you half the show spent reacclimatizing who you are.
Oh my God.
So did the Late Show go? You went from Channel 7 on to.
No, that was in 88 at 7, and then we did some. We wanted to do... We met a guy called Michael Hirsch who still works with Working Dog, and he. He was assigned to us by Mushroom Records to produce the video of that thing we did five in a row.
Yeah, right.
And he was just a mad TV fan. He was a mad Hey Hey Saturday fan. And in fact, I think, I could be wrong, he was the guy who had started the petition to have Hey Hey move from the mornings till evening. So blame him if you...
Yes.
but he was just a mad fan of old-style show business and live television and variety. And we were too. So he really set up the deal at 9 for us to do The Late Show. And we did pilots. We did 5 pilots over 8 months for The Late Show. And then Kerry Packer... decided he didn't like it, and we got, suddenly our stuff was piled out on the Nature Strip.
Right.
And then it was another 2 years before it got up at the ABC. Yeah.
And then, the Late Show is one of the most important comedy shows that's been on TV, I think.
Well, it certainly didn't feel like it at the time. It just felt, what was great about it for us is it was just an extension of the radio show. It was the people who did that show were the same, Jane Kennedy and Mick Malloy and Jason Stevens had joined by that time. And so it was the team who'd done the radio show. And now, we always say the Late Show was like year 6 and 7 of our radio show.
Yeah, yeah. Hence why it was so good, I think. Because it had the rapport and it had the structures all ready to go.
And some of the obsessions were already there.
But that was a stay-in Saturday night event.
It's funny because
especially for people my generation, I could even find something which would, like, even telling you this makes me want to throw up on myself, but
right.
When I was 16 and I had some friends turning 18,
right.
I was young, I couldn't really afford great presents, so my mate and I made videos, we'd make comedy videos and give it to them as presents.
Right, right.
And we had a shit scared. Do you know what I mean?
Really?
I reckon if you went back, you know how you said your early stuff was Monty Python?
Yes.
If you went and looked back, it's fucking, crazy-ass D-gen stuff trying to mimic the feel of, the Mr. Whippy races. And,
right.
And Shit Scared. Like, Shit Scared was just a plain fucking parody / homage /...
Well, Shit Scared was... I mean, there had been... obviously, Leo Wanker was a failed stuntman on the Paul Hogan show, but our one was more about the relationship between Mick and Rob. And Rob's sort of pomposity... Rob had the pomposity of Thrill Seekers with Chuck Connors, and Mick was just an idiot sidekick who kept undermining everything.
It's a classic dynamic,
exactly.
Isn't it? And you just waited for Rob to get angry and hit Mick. That's all you waited for.
But it was thrown together in the car park at Channel 9. I mean, it's amazing that we're even talking about it now. And that's the whole thing about it. It wasn't designed to last. It was like a newspaper. It wasn't like a book. I mean, the fact that people are still mentioning stuff from it, you just go, oh, wish we'd had 2 days to do that sketch instead of 1 day. We could have made it better.
And, there was also the great thing about it being live as well was it always felt dangerous. I remember Rob and Santo doing Jeff and Terry. I used to love those guys. And those sketches would invariably, it always felt like Jane trying to stick to script.
Those two
just deciding they'll go wherever they want. And they would just be kind of, there wasn't any real direction, but you'd just laugh. Like, you were just into it because you weren't certain what was going to happen.
Well, it was because we'd spent a lot of time on the pre-recorded stuff, and you went, now let's try and get more of mucking around into the live stuff. Because we know that even if this goes off the rails, we can go to a really good 6-minute produced piece. But the live part of it, I mean, it's just mad now to think that that was live.
Yeah.
Because hardly anyone does that now, except...
No.
I guess, but Rove's not like a comedy show. It's like
it's not on.
It's not on.
yeah, from but, you know, but you and Mick, like, were such a great dynamic at the start of the show because it would always set the table. And also, what was great was you were both funny. You both had different sensibilities, like you. But you also looked like you just really dug each other. Do you know what I mean? Like you really made each other laugh.
Well, we had become. I mean, I'd seen Mick on stage in the Uni Review that he was in, the Melbourne Uni Review, and he was real. I just gravitated to him on stage because he did less. Everyone was big, and he would do the Bill Murray less thing. And I was a huge fan of him before I worked with him. But we obviously, clearly, we're very different people. But we loved all the same things in comedy, at least in those days. And we had started doing stand-up together. Stand-up is what had actually sort of bonded us, our love of stand-up. Because we... I'm trying to remember. Do you remember the comedy club at the Hilton?
Yes.
Remember that? It was 1989. Yeah. It was this amazing year.
I never got to see it, but I know people who worked it.
There was. Tell me if you're running out of time. Am I going over?
Well, no. We're fine. Unfortunately, we've got about... I reckon we've got about 15 minutes left.
15 minutes.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But I've gotten to the DJ.
Okay.
But it's great. It's really fascinating.
Because at one point I was on Triple M and Mick and Jason were on Fox FM, which were rivals. They weren't owned by the same company in those days. And so, and that was during 1989. And the comedy club opened at the Hilton, and they would bring out, it was an amazing year where they brought out all these American stand-ups, really good American stand-ups. Franklin Ajay, Alan Havey, a guy called John Mulrooney, I remember. Rick Crom. These names would be meaningless now, I guess. The amazing Jonathan was always out here. And they would do these two-week seasons, and on the opening night, everyone from the radio stations would get to go and see it. So Mick and I would always see each other on those opening nights.
Right.
And we just became huge fans of because there was... Obviously, there's a lot of stand-up in Melbourne, but it was very... There was Anthony Morgan, who would do three-hour shows.
Yeah.
There was Mark Little, who would do these mad shows with no material. There was obviously Richard Stubbs, was probably the biggest stand-up.
Yeah.
He was sort of almost American style.
Yeah,
but,
he was.
But these guys, just seeing these guys... Franklin Ajay was the one that really... He's probably the main reason I wanted to do stand-up when I saw him. That was really my sense of humour. And so we became friends over... being fans of stand-up in that one year. But then because there's that terrible thing where we weren't well known, but we had done TV and we had done radio.
Yeah.
And but we hadn't done, you know, it's like you hadn't earned your stripes, you hadn't done stand-up.
Yeah, it's very much a on the circuit thing, isn't
it?
It's like, well, they're good on that, but put them in front of a live audience.
And so I was very... And, of course, when you've done... You've got a lot more to lose when you're not famous, but, like, you know, it's embarrassing to get up when people go, it's the guy from the radio, let's watch him die.
Yeah.
And so we were just too frightened to do stand-up,
and also,
basically.
Stand-up was a little bit more aggressive in the clubs back then, wasn't it? It was more, you know, come out with all guns blazing. And...
Yeah, it was. It wasn't the friendly sort of cardigan-y sort of rooms that you get now.
Yeah. People talking about jam and birds.
People sitting on couches. I reckon that's the key. It's really hard to have an angry heckle when you're sitting on a couch.
Yeah, you can't even raise your fist in anger.
No. So we and then this magical thing happened with the delivery room. That was the key for us. Was the Empty Pockets, Anthony Morgan, Greg Fleet, and a guy called Trev Hoare started this room called the Delivery Room. It was the Gershwin Room, but it was a night called the Delivery Room. It only went for about 6 months, but it generated, I reckon, 50% of the material from the early 90s on the comedy circuit, because they had a rope hanging from the stage.
That's right, yeah.
And you couldn't do old material. If you were doing old material, people would yell out rope, and you had to very humiliatingly go and hold this filthy, greasy rope that was hanging from the ceiling. So suddenly, it was like all of the superheroes had lost their powers.
Yeah.
Fleety couldn't do Shark Attack.
Yeah.
And so me and Mick, I went first, encouraged by Andrew Goodwin and Simon Rogers. Because I did a radio show with them on PBS called Pig on a Rope on Saturdays, and they said, yeah, come on down to the delivery room. So I went down and did 5 minutes, and it went okay. And then the next week I did 10 minutes and that went okay. And then the third week, this is at the very end of 1990, I did 10 minutes and Mick did his first spot. And then we were just away after that doing stand-up. But we were always two separate acts. We were never really a double act. And when we started working on The Late Show, that was the first and almost the only time where we really wrote together.
Oh, right, okay.
Because when we did Mark Molloy, the whole shtick was we didn't want to know what the other one was going to say. Because there was a lot of shows all the time where people just had incredibly fake laughter.
Yeah.
And they clearly hid. And we went, let's not have that. Let's genuinely surprise each other on air. So for 4 years on Mark Molloy, we were hiding our scripts from each other.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I'm a big believer in that as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like I've been in situations where they want to know what your out's going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, there's nothing funny about knowing the out.
Well, we would just do, we call it blah, blah rehearsal. If you had to do a rehearsal, we just say blah, 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 blah. Gumpy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's going to be the last word. Bring the clip in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can always just point to the person and press play at that point. Do you know what I mean? That's really interesting, that because you guys seemed, you know, from a young guy's point of view, you guys were fucking schmick.
Well, we did. I mean, stand-up was... We did a lot of stuff. I mean, I remember that 91 was our year. I think I did over 200 gigs in 91 doing stand-up. And we were just on almost every night. And we did seasons, you know... I remember us doing the comedy club for about 8 weeks, eight shows a week. And
yeah, I saw you in 92. One of the first live comedy I ever saw was the Doug Anthony All-Stars. But the first live stand-up I saw was you, Mick and Judith.
Right. Where would that have been?
That was 92? At the Adelaide Fringe.
Oh, that was 94.
That would have been 94.
Because that was after the... Because I remember me and Mick made a pact that no matter how desperate things got on The Late Show, we would never bust open our stand-up.
Yeah.
And that was what was another thing about The Late Show, was going on live TV and doing new material stand-up, having not had a chance to try it out, and not having a chance to add fake laughs afterwards.
Yeah,
so things would die in the arse on The Late Show.
The we are getting to the end of this battery, which kills me, because there's I've still got about 97,000 questions to ask you. I'll finish up with this, and I know I've mentioned this to you before, but it has been, like, my friends that I grew up with, we still quote Warren Perzo. It is hands down my favourite sketch of all time. And and my friends still, you know, if someone makes... If anyone hears something that mildly resembles a fart noise, says, excuse I. And but you've told me that died when you played it live.
That did die, because it was a long film piece, and we'd shot that ourselves on film. We love to work on film, and it's I think it got, if you listen to the original tape where it was played on the show, it gets about four laughs in 10 minutes.
You know, like the Bermagui Bronze. Like, how's that not fucking funny? That is one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
I'd like to say it was ahead of its time, but I don't think it was.
It's like, you know, like my mate who now works for the government. All I need to do is, like, when I catch up with him, the first thing he does is look at me and goes, listen, Bev. Like, it's still, it was so ingrained in my group's culture.
Well, that's a classic case of, it's a classic lesson of just do something that amuses you. Because I'd met a few of these guys through Michael Hirsch, who'd worked on Pacific Banana in the early 80s. And a lot of the quotes in that sketch are word for word things that people actually said to me.
Brilliant.
About films being about, you know, winners like Alvin Purple. and so, yeah, that was one where you go, I think maybe this is only going to amuse me. And we showed it and I went, yep, looks like it is only amusing me. But then as the years went on, people kept mentioning.
Well, you know, and it was chockers full of jokes. Like, you look in the background, it's Evil Angels 2. And it's Sigourney Weaver.
It's Aliens.
Aliens.
Well, that was... those.
Like, that is funny.
I remember, because we spent a fortune. The other thing we haven't had time to talk about is how much of our own money we insanely spent on that show. And that sketch cost 10 grand. And I remember writing a cheque for $1,500 for those two posters.
Right.
And one of them is Elise Platt and Aussie Joe Bugner in Wuthering Heights Down Under. And the other one was, I just like the idea of if there was an Evil Angels 2, it would be like Aliens, where get away from her, you bitch.
Lots of dingoes attacking.
Yeah.
Well, we'll finish up there, but I feel like that pretty much just...
I feel like we never even got into the modern era.
No,
did we even get to where you were born?
No, I'm around here somewhere in this, but if you'll come back and we can hit that, that would be fascinating.
Sure.
But thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Justin.
You've been like a massive hero of mine for so long, so it's so good to be able to hang out with you and chat about this stuff.
Thanks, Justin.
We'll get to the librarians at some point.
Oh, cool. Hey, you've won an award. Did you mention that in your podcast?
I haven't mentioned that as part of the crew.
The Equity Award for Best Comedy Ensemble.
Yeah. I've had people call out Biscuit. So,
it's better than Fat Man.
Better than Fat Man.
So there you go, Tony Martin, just fascinating guy. And to be honest, I grew up loving Tony.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Hero. Absolute hero.
Without a doubt. And to be able to spend some time with him, he directed me in The Librarians, and that was a thrill. Lucky to be on his show with Get This with Ed and the long and always loved Richard Marsland.
Yeah.
And, to be able to just sit down with him and hear this stuff is fascinating. But what's been really good is I got in touch with Working Dog Productions, and they were very kind to let us play a couple of grabs from my favourite skit.
Fantastic.
Of all time, which is the one we were talking about, the last Aussie auteur.
Yeah.
And when I look back on this, I can see how it still has informed the comedian that I am today. There's certain things I look back on.
Yeah.
I think it's, Woody Allen's moose routine.
Yeah.
It's the Doug Anthony All-Stars on the big gig. It's the Young Ones, Blackadder, and a lot of the D-Gen stuff. Rob Sitch was a massive influence on me. He used to make me laugh all the time. But this skit in particular. So what I'll do is... Let's play a couple of grabs from it just so you get a feel for it. And then you can go to our fan page on Facebook. We'll put a link to the clip up there, and then you can see this whole skit if you've never seen it before. But this first part of it is Tony as Warren Perzo, who is this film producer who is he's just out of touch with the world, and he's kind of horrendous, but he's also kind of really honest. And in it, Judith Lucy is very funny playing the straight woman interviewing him and saying all the things that we think. But this little grab here, this is from the very start of the skit and really sets up the Warren Perzo character.
Australian films today are all about and losers. They're all about Gallipoli or Burke and Wells or Breaker-Morat. I remember the days when Australian films were about winners. Blokes like Alvin Purple. See, anyone can make an arty, intellectual Last Days of Shane New flick that no bastard wants to see. I can do it. You give me a week with a camera, a couple of topless chicks, an open-top sports car and a shitload of cash, and I'll give you Out of Africa. But if you want something that's actually going to put bums on seats, something of quality, like, say, The Clinic, then that's going to take a little longer. That's going to take a bit of sensitivity, and that's where I come in. Excuse I.
Now, I've got to be honest, there's friends that I grew up with, like guys that I went to school with and played basketball with, Damien Kilsby, Greg Barden, his brother Matt Barden. Even to this day, if we hear any noise that mildly resembles a fart noise, we still look at each other and go, excuse I. I know of new friends or, friends that I've made in the last 10 years who say, excuse I, from me saying, excuse I, to fart things. But that's where it comes from.
That's brilliant. I love it.
It's so funny. And the next little grab, if we can play this, Bron, is... because what he talks about in the skit is the different movies that he's made, and they're all piss takes of older movies or older Australian films. And this next one is a movie that he made called The Bermagui Bronze, which is a piss take of an old Australian film called The Coolangatta Gold, which is about surf lifesavers doing the big... Anyway, you should watch The Coolangatta Gold. It's crazy. But this, The Bermagui Bronze, this is just funny. Rob Sitch in it, he's so hilarious. And the final bit that we cut off on when Judith Lucy tells him what David Stratton thought still makes me laugh. So let's have a little listen to The Bermagui Bronze.
Now, your next film in 1978, The Bermagui Bronze, was a multi-million dollar flop. What went wrong?
Look, I don't know. We had a terrific ad campaign.
The passion.
Listen to me, Barry! Listen to me! Listen to me, Barry! All an Iron Man! Your brother's an Iron Man! Your mum's an Iron Man! We're all Iron Men! And what have we got in common? We've all bagged the Bermagui Bronze! And now it's your turn! Go out there and come third! Come third like a real Australian athlete!
The excitement.
Joe, just got the test results from the Institute. They reckon Barry might come second, or even worse, win.
Bugger the Institute, Jock! Bugger 'em! Barry's my son, and if I say he can win the bronze, he bloody well can!
The romance.
Joe, you'll have to choose. It's either me or the Bermagui bronze.
Listen, Bev, I'm not just doing this for me and Barry. I'm doing this for everyone in this big, brown, flat, mysterious, crazy country who knows what it means to come third for Australia.
The Bermagui bronze.
David Stratton, writing in The Australian, described it as utterly shithouse.
Oh, yeah, well, he's just being anti.
Well, he's just being anti. It's one of my favourite lines in anything. So if you would like to see the rest of that skit, if you've never seen it before, it's about 10 minutes.
It's great. It's awesome.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it rewards on repeated viewings. People look at, especially in the Bermagui bronze, watch Rob Sitch's head movements. Every time something is said to him, he just reacts almost imperceptibly.
It cracks me up every time I see it.
I know. But once again, a big thank you to Working Dog for allowing us to play a couple of grabs.
Yep.
And a big thank you to Tony Martin for being a part of this show.
Brilliant.
And you know what the best thing is? We barely got up to, you know, doing radio, and there's still so much more to talk to him about, so we'll have to get him back.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
Fantastic. It worked out quite well. Thank you, Bron.
Thank you, Hamo.
And we'll talk to you very soon. Thanks for tuning in.